is made in the pages of Wine Spectator, one of the most well-read publications on wine in the world. Spectator puts out their annual list of top 100 wines this time of year, and there, at number 31 in the top 100, is a Finger Lakes wine. Forge Cellars Riesling made the list, which is fairly described as prestigious and highly anticipated. From a distance, it's hard to tell if 2020 has been a good or a bad year for the local wine industry. After all, wine shops in the Rochester area report a significant increase in sales on the year. People are drinking more during the pandemic, which is both not surprising and occasionally a problem, but that increase in sales doesn't necessarily translate evenly across the wine and spirits industry. And for an operation like Forge, part of the goal is to be part of wine lists in Manhattan or Boston or Chicago or London, for that matter. And Forge is hot in places like that. So during the pandemic, indoor dining is obviously way, way down. So the overall picture is complicated for an industry that sees very thin margins in normal years. And if you talk to winemakers, if you talk to the local industry, and we'll do that this hour, I very much expect they are worried about the scene, yes, in Rochester, and yes, in Manhattan, and everywhere. We could be on the verge of restaurant closures in large numbers, and you know who survives if that happens? Probably the chains. Probably not the types that are all that creative or thoughtful about where they're getting their wine list from. So it's tough. It's a complicated picture. The Wine Spectator ranking certainly can't hurt, and I'm always interested to know how certain producers make that list. So this hour, we've asked the co-owner of Forge Cellars to join us to talk about a strange and challenging year, the good and the bad. Rick Rainey is the co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes and the man who gets up earlier than anyone else in the region in the summer to be out there treating those vines like his babies. Rick, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm good, and we got a lot to talk about because I'm very, you know, curious to hear how it's been for you. But first of all, congratulations on the ranking in Spectator. I know it's the second time Forge has been in the top 100. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Second time actually within the last 4 years. So we were in same spot, 2015 of number 31, and then this was a complete surprise. In fact, here we are again in 2018. With our 2018 vintage at 31 again.
I hesitate to ask you this only because I don't know if there's usually a run on wines in the top 100, but exactly which wine is it for people who are wondering, Rick?
It's our flagship wine, Evan. It's we call it the Riesling Classique, which was Classique's a funny word. It was a word that Louis always used in the cellar when we were talking about our blend of all of our different vineyards. So as you know, I work in probably 18 or 19, 20 different sites on the east side of Seneca. And the Classique is our flagship. It's our snapshot of the vintage. It's the snapshot of the region. And price point wise, it would be our entry level wine at something around $17 retail. But the idea is that for consumers across the U.S. and the world, this is the wine that most people can buy, can afford to take an interest in, and hopefully they walk away with a good idea of what the Finger Lakes is all about, especially the southeast side of Seneca.
So it's the Riesling Classique from Forge Cellars. And you mentioned Louis, who is your French partner, Louis Barol, who is a partner in this enterprise. Do you speak French, by the way? I don't think I've... I know you very well. I'm not sure how good your French is.
It's atrocious.
Oh.
Now, I'll never go hungry. I will always drink well. I usually can find directions. But if we're going to have complicated conversations about the politics of the day or the weather, I'll leave that to my 11-year-old son or my wife. They're far more adept at that than I.
I am not surprised to hear your 11-year-old is ahead of you in that. He's a smart lad.
He's only been ahead of me for the last 4 years.
Yeah, okay.
So,
he's a smart lad. Talking to Rick Rainey, the co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes, who just cracked Wine Spectator's top 100. Did they tell you that's coming, by the way? I mean, like, before it's out, you probably know, don't you?
No, not a stinking clue. I was actually having a meeting, talking to a guy that does some work for me around the winery, and we were having a chat, and my phone just started vibrating and, you know, going crazy. And I said, oh, geez, well, let me see. This is something's important. And it was my distributor in Ohio. And, you know, this was kind of like a heavy meeting, and I answered the phone. I'm like, hello. And he's like, you must be so happy. You talking about?
For what?
Like, you're just having a great morning. You know, one of those voices, those like radio voices where you think you've won something. And I said, I'm like, Austin, I love you, but what are you getting at, man? He's like, number 31. And I'm like, 31? What are you? I'm going to get off the phone and drive to Ohio. We're going to have a talk. No, you're in 30, you know, top 100 again. And which it completely caught me so by surprise, you have no idea. Because honestly, this year, the focus has been so many other places. And normally I follow that, like, you know, pretty closely. And this year it kind of got away from me. So it was a welcomed surprise at about the best moment possible.
How much does it help?
Well, there's for the producer, obviously, it helps immensely. If you have wine in the pipeline, as it's, we call it, it helps to kind of move wine through. If you own wine, you're likely going to sell it off fairly quickly. From our standpoint, you know, if you're in once, that's great, and it's wonderful. But to be in twice within a few years, it really helps the brand because, you know, people want consistency. They want high-quality producers. And to be in twice in a fairly short period shows that maybe the first time wasn't luck. And so for the brand, it's really, really good. It's great exposure. I think Wine Spectator has the greatest readership in the world. But then there's this other component. So that's the selfish component. The other component is it's once again, it's our region, and I'm really keen about supporting this region, and I'm keen about spreading the word, as is Louis. So I think it shows the region is a player. We're here. We're only getting better, and I think so for the region, it's huge.
Yeah, and I think to be fair to listeners, you know, who are hearing this going, oh my gosh, I got to go get that wine. It's the 31st best wine in the world. That's not exactly what the list is. And some of the, you know, the nature of it's a little arbitrary. But tell me if you agree with sort of my analysis of this, which is this is a magazine that does cover a pretty wide world of wine. And what I mean by that is it's not just the luxury regions and brands. Right. They are looking for, you know, really, really high quality stuff in places that maybe used to be overlooked. And so when they put a top 100 list together at the end of the year, what they are signaling to the public is, number one, if a region like the Finger Lakes is repped, it gets on that list, it means that the region is worthy of respect. It's doing really well. And, you know, it's only been a few times that it's happened for the region. I think Ravines and I think Weimer has been on there. Forge has been on there twice. I'm not sure if there are others, Rick, offhand. Do you know? I don't mean to miss anybody.
I think you're right.
Okay. Yep. So I think what it says is this region is doing really, really good stuff, and we want to select a wine from this region that we think maybe is at the top of that and give them the respect and the props they deserve. That's sort of how I see it. How do you see it, Rick?
No, I agree. I mean, it's not like the best. There's so many factors that the Spectator takes into account. You know, is it available? What's the ratio of price to score, so to speak? Is it representative of the region? Is it they don't play around, you know, and I respect them for that. Some people may not always agree with their scores, but I think as a publication, they're very consistent. They have a pretty stringent approach to wine. And so that's why this particular one is really important to me, because I believe in what they're doing. And I think they're a very buttoned up organization in a lot of ways. Now, you know, when people judge things, it's always open to criticism. But they've been around a long time, and they're consistent, so it's hugely important.
Well, and one more point on that, because this is a little bit of how the sausage is made, and the public doesn't always see it. But when you see scores on wines, you know, I'm sort of hot and cold on scores. I don't necessarily love scores because I don't think you can necessarily just affix a number to something like that a wine that is changing and say that, this wine is 90 and it will always be 90. This wine's 88. This wine is 84. This wine's 95. I don't love that, but I understand the utility. And I do think there's utility if the person doing that is consistent. And the person who brought consistency and high quality, I think, writing and care to the region is James Molesworth, who listeners might know more for his fitness videos, but he is a phenomenal he really is a phenomenal and buttoned up wine writer. He's also the kind of guy who shows up and he doesn't just sort of dote on producers. He's very professional. So what I wanted to ask you is, as good as it feels to land in the top 100, and again, congratulations on that, these wines I know are your babies. So what is it like when you see a score published and the score is lower than you think one of your babies deserves and you go, come on? I mean, that has to happen once in a while.
It has, with James in particular.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I've followed James. I've been doing this for, a long time, and I followed his work. And he's given me a couple scores that at the moment, I think being a fair, I mean, this is our 10th vintage. So there's been an immense amount of evolution personally. For me, just as a business owner, as somebody in the business of wine, I've just grown so much. And in the early years, I went from being a buyer and judging everybody else's work. That was what I did in France. I would spend 30, 45 days a year in France, in cellars, judging everybody else's work, depending on how much am I going to buy, what do I think of this wine, and so forth. Then I went to being the judged. And that was a huge change in my perspective. And so in the early years, I was very hypersensitive to it. And sometimes he would give stuff, I thought, a couple points lower than it should. But in retrospect, I'll have to say, I think for the most part, looking back, he was pretty dead on. I think sometimes he was a little conservative, but I get it. We're a new region. We still have lots to learn. And you just can't hand it all over. So, maybe there's a side to me that now thanks him because it made me somewhere push a little harder. Not to say we wouldn't have pushed harder because, as you know Louis personally, he only knows one way. And that way is push as far as we can possibly go. So, I'm okay with it all. I'm okay with it.
Talking to Rick Rainey, co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes. And it's the 2018 Riesling Classique that got number 3. That's 2018 is the vintage, Rick. Is that right?
Yes, sir. The famous vintage of 2018.
So we're going to talk about that in a second. Their 2018 Riesling Classique is number 31 on Wine Spectator's top 100 wines in the world list for 2020. And in a moment, we're going to shift and talk about what this pandemic has done I don't know if it's done for. I mean, it's done some things for wine sales, but I don't think it's been totally equitable. We'll talk about that in a moment here. But 2018 is very interesting that one of your wines from 2018 ends up on a top 100 in the world list because 2018 in the Finger Lakes was like making wine in a can of soup. I mean, you want to let people know what it was like?
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, it was. I mean, I think we've discussed it. I was on my way to work around 5:15 in the morning. I had a big day ahead of me, and I came up over the hill coming from Trumansburg over to Seneca Lake, and it was just raining like mad. And I pulled out on the 414 and passing my local watering hole, Lucky Hair there, and the water was coming down the slope so fast it picked up my full-size Toyota truck and lifted it and set it sideways. And I pulled out on the 414, and it did it two or three more times, and I had to avoid rocks and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I got into the heart there of Hector, and there's a ambulance and a fire engine and these fellas standing out there just getting drenched. I said, gee, guys, I'll tell you, I'm in a full-size truck, and I know how to drive. I'm pretty comfortable, but that was pretty hairy. I don't know if I would let somebody go up that road. And they looked at me and go, hey, Rick, it's closed. Oh, okay. So that was it. I think it was something like 10 inches of rain that day. It was just, it was catastrophic. And what it did was beat up the vines pretty good. It put a lot of pressure on them. And they had a rough go of it, and they did the very best they could, but it was like they were in a, you know, a 15 round heavyweight fight, and the vines themselves and the fruit were just real beat up. And so you had disease, lots of disease pressure. You had this variation where you had disease, but then you had non-disease fruit, and they looked very similar. So you had to pay a lot of attention in the vineyard. You had to work closely with the hand pickers to show them the difference. It was difficult for everybody. And I kid you not, even now when I talk to grower friends, you know, they'll give a faraway look or stare at their shoes and shake their head about 2018 because it left a mark. It hurt. There's no doubt.
Well, I know you and really some of the top producers worked so hard to get high quality stuff. I wouldn't want that job. But then you had 2020. This was nice this year, wasn't it? I mean, the very different than 2018 this year.
So we had 2018, nearly killed me. Woke up after harvest, had mono for 2 or 3 months. 2019 was a little bit easier. I was like, oh, okay. And then 2020, and you know, as you know, I mean, Louis couldn't come, so I was flying solo this year, completely solo. Had my team, my team here, but no help from France. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, Mother Nature, if you can do me this one solid and give me a vintage where it flows, we don't have huge, giant risks to take. We don't have huge decisions to make. If you can just be a little gentle. And she did. And she did in a lot of ways, because it was imperative that we had great weather, not only for the vines, but for all of the fellow winery owners that moved all of their business outside. And that had an immense impact, you know, for the economy, because if we had a classic, you know, rainy mixed summer that we often see in the Finger Lakes, it would have just been horrible. But we had great day after great day after great day. So the vines loved it. I think the local wineries were thankful. And then when harvest came, it sailed in. It was like 2016. Clean, everything was clean. I picked. I was done my last Riesling pick, and it snowed the next 2 days. So I figured, all right, I did the right thing here. And the wines, I think, are going to be, you know, often I talk about wines. It's a weather wine, it's a mineral wine or an earth wine or a sun wine, and this is going to be a sun wine. These wines are going to be very fruity, very forward, very clean, very pretty. I think it's going to be a great vintage all the way around.
Well, I think you deserve that, and I want to talk more about this year outside of the weather and the vintage for you guys down there in the industry. I am curious to know, Rick, just let's start with this. You know, when I talk to local wine shops in Rochester, their sales in April, May, they say it was like holiday month sales, and they haven't really seen any significant downturn. I mean, people, as I said at the outset of this conversation, people have been drinking more. You understand that. That's not always good. I mean, it can be a glass of wine can be a balm at night. For some, it could be too many, but the bottom line is we've seen sales up. I don't know that means it's equally good for everybody in the industry. So take me through that. How has it been?
Well, you know, when the pandemic hit, you had buying, which was very risk-averse buying, panic buying, as it's called, I guess. And people were buying the staples, toilet paper and wine brands they knew well. And so you saw the bigger brands that people have grown up with did incredibly well. Now, the industry, the restaurant industry is incredibly important to small producers because they have the ability to tell the stories. And it also adds value to them as a business because they work with small growers and it makes it very interesting for the consumer. And growing up in the wine business, you know, we were always told that all the great brands are built in restaurants. And because they have the time to tell the stories. And a lot of times retailers don't. And this was the case when the pandemic hit. The retailers were up to their eyeballs. They had staffing issues. It was just insanity. So the big brands were doing very well. And the whole time I was just saying to all my friends, this scares me because they're not building any more stores. They're not increasing sizes. So the shelf space is the shelf space. And if you're not in the mix, it's going to be very difficult to get in. And we lost literally half of our customer base in New York because the restaurants were gone. They disappeared. So it's been a wild ride. Now it's coming back a little bit. We had some restaurant business open up during the summer. In the fall, it's shut down again. But the retailers now, I think, are looking at new places and looking for new things. And that's great news, because we need that. We need this constant, we want our retail partners to have eyes wide open so that they can support these people that might have been in restaurants that have no place to go.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about restaurants. I mean, when you think about where Forge is, do you know even off the top of your head how many restaurants you're in, your wines are in?
Yeah, I was in New York State. I can only tell you New York State. That's the only numbers I have. But I was probably in about 150, give or take.
150 in the state?
Yes.
Okay. How many of those, for example, are in Manhattan?
Manhattan is, it was good. It was good. Probably, 40 or 50 in Manhattan.
When you look at...
And good places, like interesting, places that you're proud to be in and that you're excited when somebody sends you a picture and look where I am and your wine's on the list, like, because you know that chef's doing great work, or that chef is just cutting edge and, doing local, and you feel really good to be, because you feel kind of a part of the restaurant.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, we talked to Caleb Ganser on the program a couple of months back about his work in New York City, and then bringing his operation up to Cayuga Lake for the summer into the fall. And, his concern, he said, was that he thought government was not clear-eyed enough about what was a possible catastrophic permanent closure of restaurants that was already happening by the time I talked to Caleb on this program, but permanent closure of restaurants, often independent, one-offs. We're not talking chains. And he says, if all you're left with is chains, we're in trouble in the industry. Do you share that concern, Rick?
Oh, without a doubt. It's been heart-wrenching. I mean, we know a lot of the same guys, the Arts over at Lento, and the wonderful people at the Cub Room, and geez, Kevin, from McCann's. I mean, it was like somebody was stomping on my heart for the guy. My son has his poster in his room, because every time I come home with a dry aged ribeye on the grill, I mean, the guy's like a saint in my house. And I came home and I explained around the dinner table, I listened to the interview with him, and I just had tears in my eyes. I mean, these are great, dynamic, intelligent, hardworking people that support the, support the farmers, support the community. And they don't do it for the money. I mean, it's an affliction. Like, we all do this because we can't imagine doing anything else. It's in our blood, and it's just the only thing we can fathom doing. And to see the legs kicked out from underneath them, it's been heart-wrenching. It really has.
So when it comes to your ability and the efforts that you and the team at Forge have made in 10 years in business to get into 150 restaurants in this state, I know you're on lists elsewhere. Mm-hmm. What is a worst case scenario coming out of this pandemic for just your business, and your placement in those restaurants?
Well, the holy grail is to be in restaurants that you yourself would love to go to, right? That is where people are artists that are doing amazing things. Those restaurants are the ones that were hardest hit, because that style of dining is not as conducive to outdoor dining, and they have far more limitations. So I don't know what's going to happen, frankly, what the future is going to look like. I mean, a lot of these people are very creative. They'll likely pivot and take some time and start to reinvent themselves. But there's going to be a heavy price paid for not having in place a system that could support this industry while we dealt with the pandemic. And it's going to be a heavy price. There's just absolutely no doubt. I don't want to be pessimistic, but there's going to be certainly casualties.
Yeah. And when I look at the industry, the wine industry in Western New York, I mean, the Finger Lakes in particular, There are, I don't know how many licensed bonded wineries there are now. I mean, it's way more than I would have guessed a decade ago could be sustained by the industry. There was this steady drip of opening. And, you know, for a long time, throughout the 90s into the aughts, I mean, a lot of wineries in the region, and probably still today, try to just get by with tasting room sales. They do some restaurant placing here and there, but you get to a saturation point where there's too much competition, and you have to be in restaurants, you have to be in wine shops, you've got to be in different places. How important is that chunk of your business? So if we see widespread restaurant closures, for farmers like you guys who are trying to be competitive and stay in business, there's not huge margins here. How important is the restaurant piece for you, Rick?
The restaurant piece. It does a bunch of things. It's obviously very good for consumption. I mean, they go through a lot of wine, but also they're the best storytellers. They relate the region. They help the region. They build the brand of the region, which benefits all of us. So there's we're going to miss the sales, obviously, hugely important. Can we make the sales up in retail? So far, it looks as if we can, but it's not going to be easy, and it's going to take some time, but the more important thing for me is we're not going to have we used to have thousands upon thousands of ambassadors in independent restaurants across the U.S. saying, you ever hear the Finger Lakes? Yeah, here's this guy doing this, but look at this place. This is cool. You should check this out. Low alcohol, fresh, minerally white wines, some of the best in the U.S. Huh, I might have to go there one day. I live in Cleveland. That's not far from us. I live in Boston, 7 hours. I might have to go up there. I mean, this is the role that restaurants play for people like us, as well as obviously purchasing the wine.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And so that impact, you can't necessarily even measure right now or next month or the next month. I mean, this could be sort of thing that that erodes that drip of new faces for a number of years if it goes this way. Talking to Rick Rainey, co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes. And Rick, for you, what was the year like in terms of visits, visitors who are doing guided tastings, things like that? What was it like?
Well, I was pretty fortunate because the 2018 vintage was not a huge vintage for us. We sold the wines very well and fairly quickly. And so I didn't open this year until August, which was just a blessing in disguise because, frankly, I watched what everybody else was doing. The guys had had to go out there and kind of invent this thing from scratch. Now, fortunately for us, we've always been appointment only and with a sit-down guided tasting. So it was hard baked into our culture to be this way. What I had to do was change the setup a little bit. I would only see six people at a time and instead of 14. And so, we would see 28, 30 people in a day. Now we see six people in a day, but it would take 5 or 6 hours. I'm sorry, 30 people in a day, but it would take 5 or 6 hours to do that. So we had to change up and how we served the wines. We served them individually in little milk bottles. We adapted. As far as visits, it was very busy. We were open only Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And generally speaking, we had a waiting list every weekend. So people wanted to come taste the wines. I didn't have the facilities to accommodate them. I need to make some changes. COVID has shown to me that, I need to reinvest and I have to make Forge a little bit more available to more people. In the neighborhood, speaking with friends, they worked incredibly hard. They change their models, but for the most part, it may actually be a fairly beneficial thing because this type of tasting, I think everybody's wanted to do for a long time, which is a sit-down, guided, focused, what we would consider a high-level style of tasting wine versus sitting around a bar and here's the next wine kind of idea. So maybe it's a blessing in disguise in some ways that we can now, as an industry, go that direction and give people a little bit different of an experience. And for the most part, everything I heard from all of our customers that had visited, our friends along 414 had great things to say. And people really embraced it.
Are you saying that you don't relish every every two-story bachelor party or bachelorette party bus that comes in.
Listen, everybody wants to have a good time in those places, and there's room for that somewhere. For me, I break out in hives every time I have to even consider it. God bless those that deal with it, because it's a different gig. It's a totally different gig. And that's been one of the challenges in the Finger Lakes, is that we've had to do both. And that's really, really difficult. I mean, think of a restaurant that's doing, really great fine dining, but it turns around and has to sell hot dogs out of the side door. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's tough. Talking to Rick Rainey from Forge Sellers, how has the government response been at all levels, Rick? I mean, this is a challenging problem that most of us never thought we'd live through, but I am curious to know, as a business owner, how you see the effectiveness or not of government response at multiple tiers of government.
Well, of course, Triple P was wonderful. It didn't have much of an impact in my business because it was based upon labor at the slowest period of the year, which was odd. My labor comes in the fall, and it's huge dollars. In the winter, my labor is not, very, very small. So it was fine. It was fine. The big one was going to be the EIDL loan, and that was great. And I thought, oh, wow, this is going to be fantastic. 3%, good terms. This is going to give us operating capital to get through a time that we know nothing about. We have no idea what's going to happen. And you thought, this is going to be good. Okay, I can keep paying people. I can go to harvest. I can buy my dry goods. I can pay for my growers. I can do all these great things. Except when I found out I couldn't get it because I have a French partner. So for me, that was a big kick in the gut. And I reached out to everybody, all their names. And I just said, how can this be? How can I have a French partner who took euros, turned them into dollars, and we're not talking inconsequential sums, and invested them in this region to build an American company that pays taxes, that buys, Vance tanks, that injects hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars into the economy, but I'm not eligible. And so that's been a bitter pill to swallow. I mean, fortunately, that they have 401ks, and I was able to just pull out of my savings and plow it into Forge. But that was a big one. So I think, I feel even bad talking about it, because frankly, at least I was able to do that, and at least I still had sales. I look at my restaurant friends, and their plight is, I feel lucky actually compared to them, because at least we were still selling some wine, and we still had the internet, and the channels were in place to still continue to sell wine, versus those guys that they had to shut their doors.
Yeah. So as we get ready to close the hour, I want to read an email and kind of touch more on this subject that Rick just brought up here. Andrew writes to say, I'm a member of the New York State Wine Grape Growers Association. I've grown grapes on a very small plot of land for almost 30 years. I've worked hard on this hobby with the pros watching my vines. I've suffered setbacks both in the vineyard and in the carboys. I've also had some good results. Since I am so small of a grower, I can only imagine what it takes to be a professional grower and winemaker, to depend on your craft for a living. Rick, I salute you on your achievement. Cheers. That is from Andrew. And to Andrew's point there, it's a good one, because people think about wine sometimes as a luxury product. And, it's hard to get your head around the fact that even if you think of wine that way, mm-hmm. It is farming. The creation of it is farming. It is dirt under the fingernails, long hours, low margins, and often years without making much money or just trying to survive. And so I just want people to kind of get that juxtaposition in their head, because it matters here. And when you think about the restaurant industry, fine dining may be fine dining, but the people who are toiling away are really hurting and struggling right now. So, Rick, when you think about whether it's your friends in restaurants, your friends in the wine industry, for those who are really hurting the most, For people who have debated what the government should do, the one word that I hear is very sensitive is bailout, because bailout sort of gets applied to when banks have behaved irresponsibly or automakers didn't adjust to the consumer market. A pandemic is not a bailout. It is a you have to close or you have to be limited situation, and it's not your friends and your colleagues' fault there. But should there be a backstop for especially those in the restaurant industry, but for those in these kinds of industries who are basically told you've got to be closed?
I mean, you've covered this in every way to Sunday, and we've all heard everybody speak about this, and everybody has an opinion. Mine is very simple. And if we've determined for the public good that certain sectors of our commerce, of our business, should shut down for the common good, no problem. But the idea of a civilized society is that we all contribute to this giant pot. And when things get rough, we dip into that pot and we take care of the segments of society that are most adversely affected. And I didn't see that occur. I was happy to do whatever is good for the greater good, but I just felt as if when it gets really rough, think maybe, you know, somebody's going to have your back. And when they don't, it's just a really hard pill to swallow. And that's how I felt for my restaurant friends. I saw the hard work, everything they've done correctly. And then through no fault of their own, literally through an act of nature, God, their businesses are gone. And that's a tough one. That's a tough one. So I hope, in the spring, when everything gets back to normal, we can all visit them and support them and the ones that are left and do everything we can to bring back these artisans, these people that give us pleasure, that take us away for an hour or two and take us out of our day-to-day life and give us something to think about. Hopefully we can bring some of these guys back.
Yeah, standing ovation for that. Rick Rainey is the co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes. Forge Cellars had a wine, number 31 on Wine Spectator's 2020 Top 100 Wines in the World list. It is their 2018 Riesling Classique. And I know in past years, whether it was Herman J. Wehmer or Ravines or Forge, on this list, some people go, oh my gosh, it's December 23rd. I'm running out. I haven't gotten enough for Christmas. I'm going to grab one of those wines. I'm going to stick it under the tree. I'm going to cut out the article. We're going to support local. It's a cool thing to do. And I think that wine is still available now, but who knows in the next hour or two. Rick, for you and the team and your whole family, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and I hope things track in a better direction for all folks in this industry and related industries. Always appreciate the insights, my friend.
Hey, chin up and keep dreaming forward, and best to you. Have a great holiday.
You got it. Rick Rainey, Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes. More connections coming up.